G'day, team. Welcome to another installment of your favourite podcast. Tiffany Ann Cook over there at TYP, the U Project Central. As always, the boss of me, steering the ship, the glue that holds this very shonky bloody production together. How are you?
I'm very good, Harps. How are you?
You look like a grown-up today because you're not wearing training gear. You're actually in like a grown-up's top. What's going on?
It's
Are you trying to freak me out?
I've been brushing my hair lately.
Wow.
I'm not going to say that.
What are you doing this for? Like, what's the revolution? Because I'm used to seeing you with messy hair, who's just finished some kind of high-intensity 1.5-hour workout, who sits there with headphones on and sweat pouring down her forehead. What's going on?
Well, when we live our lives inside our house, sometimes getting dressed makes me feel like I'm going out and doing something different. I feel like I've been out for the day because I've put a grown-up jumper on instead of a muscle top.
And when before Stephen jumped on the podcast and he's sitting there patiently, you told me off because we're talking to one of the world's greatest minds and researchers and scientists, and I'm wearing a T-shirt that says, "Sorry, I'm late. I didn't want to be here." And so I had to make sure that the camera is above that so that he doesn't take it personally. I'm actually very excited. Now, Steve, before I intro you, I'm going to read a little bit about your significant bio. Stephen Lauriers is a Belgian neurologist recognized worldwide as a leading clinician and researcher in the field of neurology of consciousness. He graduated as a medical doctor. That was his first thing. Obtained a master's in pharmaceutical medicine. Of course he did. Working on pain and stroke, and then obtained his PhD studying residual brain function in the vegetative state. He currently leads the Coma Science Group, unless this is outdated, he'll fill me in a moment, the Coma Science Group at the Cyclotron Research Centre of the University of Liège in Belgium. He is a clinical professor of neurology, aren't we all, at the Liège University Hospital and research director at the National Fund for Scientific Research. He's also written some cool books. I think his most recent is Meditation and the Brain. The No Nonsense Meditation book. Also, The Neurology of Consciousness and Meditation is Good for Your Brain. Did I get any of that wrong, Stephen?
It's okay. You did wonderfully.
Now, what did I miss out? Because when you're kind of Googling stuff, it's handy, but it's not like it's coming straight from the horse's mouth. What did I miss?
No, it's perfect. So as you mentioned, I'm a clinician seeing patients. Expertise is the damaged brain, but we're here to talk about neuroplasticity, meaning, you know, the capacity of the brain to change itself in another context, and that's meditation. And I'm talking to you from Canada, where I'm an invited professor at the University of Laval and putting up an international lab, always still with the subject of trying to understand human consciousness.
I'm really interested in people who work at the level you do. Firstly, thanks for coming on the U Project. We
Pleasure.
Really appreciate it. I'm interested in people who work at the level that you do, who's part of your job or part of your passion, perhaps, is to disseminate high-level scientific information to the masses. You know, it is like to be an effective science communicator where everyone can kind of understand and relate and be a bit inspired is not an easy job. Has that been something that you have had to develop over time?
I think it's an important part of our mission, right? We receive public funding, and I think I have the most wonderful job there is, being paid to think and push the boundaries of, you know, our understanding, or maybe it's better to say our ignorance. We talk about consciousness is really one of those biggest mysteries. So I'm very happy to do that. Writing scientific papers, scientific books is one thing, but share that with anyone. And I'm son of a farmer. So I like simple phrasing, and also the book, I think it's too easy to hide behind your jargon and complicated words. So it's also what we do with of course the families we see, just try to say as good as we possibly can what we think we understand.
Do you think our understanding of consciousness and mindfulness and meditation and just the way that the brain works and the mind works, do you think that our understanding over the last, say, 200 years has been a linear progression, or is it accelerating?
It has been progressing. It's not a linear process, right? We depend on the technology and like Galileo could make new discoveries about astronomy, and that was because he had good telescopes. And now our telescopes, the machines that permit us to zoom in on the workings of the brain, are wonderful, and we use functional MRI, and yet we are also frustrated because we don't have the machine to help us to visualize, to see the thousands of billions of brain connections in your brain right now in that soup of neurotransmitters at the millisecond resolution. So we make progress, but I can't say if, you know, we understand currently, and it's been 25 years that with the team I'm working on, you know, the human mind by all possible means. And did we, I don't know, reduce or know more about the problem and 50% or 5% or 0.005%. We don't know what we don't know. So that's the thing about science. You make some discoveries and then you understand, well, it's way more complicated than we initially thought.
We've been thinking about thinking for a long time, haven't we?
Since the beginning of mankind. It was the field of philosophy and religion. Talking about consciousness, when I started in the 90s, was kind of taboo. And I don't think it's good that scientists kind of auto-censor their areas of interest.
Yeah, when I was starting my PhD, I was trying to find some reference to the earliest kind of documented stuff around self-awareness. And I'm sure you're probably more all over it than I ever will be. But Socrates wrote, 2,500 years ago, the beginning of wisdom is to know thyself, you know, and even back then, 2,500 years ago, they were thinking about what's the me experience like, how, you know, from that, I heard you speaking about internal and external self-awareness is to try to have some kind of this is what fascinates me. This part of my research is trying to understand what's the me experience for other people. Like, what's it like being around Craig? Because I've never been around me because I am me. And this is, you know, when you've got no idea of what it is like being around you, it makes things like communication, connection, rapport, problem solving, teamwork much harder. But then when you introduce to people the idea of the you experience, some people get very defensive because they think it's got to be a critical thing rather than an awareness thing.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. This is the challenge, that we have this capacity to think about our own thinking. And it's also why basically I started this journey, confronted two patients in coma, where, you know, you are feeling very frustrated. And then looking at other conditions like pathological and pharmacological coma, anesthesia, but also psychedelics, the power of the mind in hypnosis, in studying athletes, and how this is also helping you as a human person. And you mentioned, you know, your self-awareness and how do others see you. And it's something where I think it's important to make the difference between knowledge. And that's what, we emphasize a lot, the knowledge part in our educational system. And then there's, you know, the experience, which is also something I think maybe is a bit neglected and is very complementary. And so the study of meditation for me was also an out of my comfort zone experience, because, you know, you have the theoretical knowledge and models and frameworks, but then meditating yourself and living the experience, I think, is part of this. And it's one of the big challenges. We have these machines we discussed to make images of the workings of the mind, but still we need to couple that to what is this person, Craig or whoever it be, in my machine thinking, perceiving, feeling, and that kind of neurophenomenology. It's very hard to do. What do you think right now? And what do I measure with my machines, and how can that help me? Is fascinating, and it will be a couple of Nobel Prizes, I think, before we can truly answer your question about self-awareness and our ego.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to you winning those Nobel Prizes, and we'll get you back when you do that. No pressure. But I think also, too, what I'm fascinated about is, you know, like, so for example, we have about 10,000 people a day listen to this show, right? And we go, so there's 10,000 people listening to you and I, not necessarily at the same time, of course, but, and Tiff when she chimes in, but 10,000 people listening to the same guys share the same information, but no one's having the same experience of us.
Absolutely.
Like same stimulus, same input, but different experience, ranging from this is complete garbage to this is fascinating, keep going, to I want to hear more, to I'm confused, to oh no, this all makes sense. You know, it's that common stimulus, but the range of experiences that come from the one thing, meaning we create our own reality on a level.
All the time. And it's this is the beauty, right? That we all have these experiences and the differences, and also making it sometimes challenging to communicate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, I think it's something that maybe we could, you know, pay a little bit more attention to. What are you understanding, feeling right now? What about myself? It's a tough question. How do I feel? And that would help in interacting between human beings and with other living creatures, which is maybe one of the big challenges currently. And we see it with the COVID crisis. So maybe we should connect a little bit more with the subjective selves and our irrational parts, intuition and emotions. And we live in a world of, you know, high technological means, hyper-connected virtual realities, and all of that is wonderful. We have these, you know, Zoom meetings right now. And still we have social animals needs that maybe we've been neglecting a little bit. And emotional intelligence, we know, is so important. And yet in schools, we don't do much about trying to, you know, train those parts of the human mind.
Maybe that's because the people who are teaching don't understand it. And I don't mean that offensively, but it's not something that's really front of mind in a lot of academic settings. Do you think that understanding others, not agreeing with or aligning with, but just understanding someone else's reality or somebody else's, you know, state, is more of an emotional or intellectual or perhaps intuitive task?
I think there's both. I think you can, and that's what I, you know, summarize in the No Nonsense Meditation book. You can cultivate empathy, compassion, and then there's the cognitive component of this. So yes, you can think about how is Craig feeling right now and Tiff, and then there's just, you know, this, as you mentioned, intuitive, even unconscious level of you know, a lot of things going on when we meet. And all of that, of course, is important. And I think something that we're not machines, we don't want to become robots or ignore or repress our emotions. And that is what I unfortunately see as a neurologist, you know, dealing with people who have sleeping problems and anxiety, burnout or tension, headache, chronic pain, whatever. It's very often we need to go through a crisis before suddenly we pay attention to, hey, I'm more than just this rational me. And how do I do that? And for me, meditation was, yes, a discovery and a bit strange. I never, ever was told anything about this in medical school or during my training as a neurologist.
What precipitated that discovery? What opened that door?
Well, as often it's a crisis. So you can read the details in the book for those interested, but that was 2012. And suddenly I was alone with the three young kids and, you know, the little voice in your head starting to go around and anticipating the future, because that's what your brain does. It's a prediction machine. It's very, very important. It permitted us to increase our chances of survival. We can anticipate things, but that little voice and that anticipation can just go in overdrive, and then you're catastrophizing. And I was thinking, it's impossible. I'm not able to do that. My job at university, hospital, three young kids, and do the washing. And then also going over and over the past. How could this happen? And it, of course, you can't change the past. And then it keeps you from falling asleep and makes you anxious during the day. And what I did, and many medical doctors I understood since do, is starting to drink, right? So alcohol, wonderful. It puts a break on the mind. Smoking, you know, stress relief, taking pills, sleeping pills, antidepressants. And that wasn't the inspiring dad I wanted to be. So then started to do yoga. And then it was a meeting with Mathieu Ricard. I don't know if you know the man, the Buddhist.
He was an academic who became a Buddhist monk.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's a PhD from Institut Pasteur, molecular biology, had his own existential crisis, went to India, Nepal, now is the translator of the Dalai Lama. I met him in Paris. He gave a TEDx talk there on compassion, meditation, and I was giving a talk on the brain and consciousness. And so, he has that, you know, sensibility, feeling that I wasn't the best, I was struggling. And he said, well, come on a retreat with me. And that's what we did, first retreat of mine in Live Europe, and was really wonderful experience for me. And then I told him, well, you come to my lab in Belgium and I'll put you as a guinea pig and all our machines and see what meditation does with the brain. And that's how the book came about.
Wow. And what happened for you on that retreat without divulging anything you don't want to, but I feel like you're a pretty open book, no pun intended. What did you become aware of, or what shift happened?
Three levels. The first one is personal. So there I saw an opportunity to deal with my struggles differently. I felt a little bit like, you know, the amateur being sent to the Olympic Games, because it was full of Buddhist monks and all experts in meditation. And I was sitting there, and then, you know, someone goes bong and it's silent. And there you sit and your knees start to hurt, and you don't know how long is this going to take, and again spinning, and that's the exercise. And it was wonderful, because I there learned that, well, we all have this monkey mind, right? We just have this continuous stream of consciousness, thoughts going from one to the other, and then you can learn to create some distance and you are not your thoughts, and you can let them fly by like clouds in the sky. And that was very powerful. But also as a scientist, of course, I'm interested in human consciousness. So meditation and discussing with these athletes of the mind is wonderful. And finally, as a clinician, you know, and I now prescribe meditation. I have this in my toolbox. Of course, it's very useful that I can prescribe drugs and interventions, but it's not the only thing. And that was wonderful on all those three axes. And of course, for the lab started a new era of research. And also a friend, because Mathieu stayed with us, had long discussions with the kids, and you know, about value. What do we want to do with our lives? I have wonderful children, now five, and the older ones, as teenagers, you know, were challenging me. Why do you eat meat, for example? And in the book, I tell this little anecdote, because it's not easy to cook for a vegetarian and then, you know, have another meal aside and so on and so forth. And my son, Hugo, who was very convinced that he should be vegetarian, I told him, if you don't eat meat, you will never have hair on your little one.
That's terrible parenting, but hilarious.
It is terrible. It worked, though. It worked. He started eating meat again.
Wow.
And then Mathieu Ricard came and you know, discussed with him and the rest of the family. And of course, said that that's complete bull. And since then, he's really our ethical compass. And of course, we eat. We should think about, you know, what's on our dish. So it's been a wonderful journey on many, many aspects of my life. And that's also why I want to share it, basically, in this book. Doing well, I'm so happy. It's out in Australia. It's been translated in more than 10 languages now. So clearly there is the need. And I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a Zen master. I try to, you know, tell and summarize the science and some exercises. And I would say, if I can do it, anyone can do it.
And it's called the No Nonsense Meditation Book, A Scientist's Guide to the Power of Meditation. So I'm going to get it. I'm definitely going to get it and read it because I need to. Isn't it nice when, you know, you can bring all your study and research and your understanding and all your data collection and knowledge over the years, and you can collide that with personal experience where you can have a personal revelation that's just impacts you profoundly. And then you can bring all of that together and ask more questions and get more answers and help more people, you know, out of not just out of kind of scientific curiosity, but also compassion and love.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important to experience this. So I've been studying the human mind more than 25 years. Imagine I would be a scientist interested in color vision, right? I would know everything there is to know about seeing color, what's happening in your brain, all the neurotransmitters. And yet I would see the world in black and white, okay? Mm. So the day I would see truly in color, that would change something. Right. Mm. So the difference between knowledge and experience again, and I think it's the same for meditation. I started my career studying sleep and dreaming. It's fascinating. Why do we dream? And I had some colleagues who didn't recall their dreams, and their approach was very different. So I think it does influence. By the way, we also study near-death experiences with the Coma Science Group. Maybe Craig and Tiff, if I can, for all those listening in Australia who had such an experience, and we're talking about people who had a coma after cardiac arrest, for example, we think they're comatose and unconscious, and yet afterwards they tell me, well, I had this experience of complete bliss, the light, sometimes leaving your own body. we have very little scientific studies, a lot of Hollywood, you know, movies and media interest, but we want to know what it is like. And I feel very frustrated because I never had one. So if anyone listening now had a near-death experience, please share it. We're doing a lot of research. Neuropsychologists can give you questionnaires. Just send us your experience at NDE, from near-death experience, at uliege.be. We'll write it down so people can be part of the science and the more than 2,000 testimonies we have to date.
Yeah, definitely. All right, we will put that in our notes because my audience just went, what was that middle bit? Definitely, we will put that in our notes. Tiff, can you take a note for yourself, make a note for yourself?
I knew you were going to say that, and I was like, I don't know how to spell whatever he just
Well,
said.
That's right. Well, that's why we're going to. Do you know who Matthew Walker, the sleep research dude, is?
Absolutely. Wonderful book.
Yeah. He's that. I've been listening to him recently too. It's there are so many things that on a superficial level, of course, we know. But when you dig into the science and you dig into all of the variables around, even, you know, just how many things sleep can affect, from, you know, longevity to obviously immune system, to health, to conversations, to energy, to productivity, to depression, sadness, joy, you know, internal world, external world, just the difference in being able, and all of the other things that influence sleep, like caffeine. And I heard him talking yesterday, and I drink too much coffee, Tiff. Wow. I need to, you know, there's like a relationship. He reckons up to about 3 cups a day good. Beyond that starts to be the damaging potential.
And
do you have any thoughts on that?
8 p.m. coffee, Harps.
What?
You have 8 p.m. coffees, and that's
I know.
Not good.
I literally, well, when I'm doing a workshop at night, Stephen, I literally go and buy a coffee, a large one, and I sit there while I'm doing, because I do mentoring groups from 8 till 10. And so I sit there with a coffee from 8 till 10 and inhale all this caffeine and then go to bed. Maybe I've got a high tolerance. Maybe that's bad. What are your thoughts around all that?
Well, I think you should try meditation, Craig. And you talk about sleep.
Really?
I think this is all just part of our life hygiene, right? It's your physical well-being and exercising, what you eat, your social relations, quality of your sleep. And meditation is like mental gymnastics. It's just part of you taking care of you. So coffee is wonderful, but of course, yeah, if you take too much, it can be a challenge. But you seem to do well.
I go, okay, I'm 74 years old. No, I'm 58. I'm not 58. I'm 57. I think I'm a little bit older than you, but you look annoyingly young. Like,
thank you. Actually, the brain of Mathieu Ricard, he's 70 plus, yeah. Truly is. And I have it here with me. Can you see this?
I hope that's not the actual brain, but that's a model.
This is a 3D print of the MRI we took from Mathieu. And then we can measure this, you know, and compare it to other people matched. And neurologically speaking, he is like 10, 15 years younger.
Yeah.
So meditation truly is good for your brain. And in the book, you'll see the parts of the brain that are specifically larger than, you know, other people his age, which is in the hippocampus, important for memory, in parts that regulate attention, and meditation is all about learning to direct your attention. And then this part here, left prefrontal, because that's important in your mental well-being and happiness. Mathieu is also called, a journalist once said, you're the most happy person on earth. So this is still something he is sometimes used to refer. And indeed, you can do, as we said, loving kindness and compassion training, and we would really see structural changes in people who meditate. And of course, no need to become a Buddhist monk, you know, to take care of your neurological age, Craig. We can all do it. And programs like mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is eight weeks program, have shown a similar effect in you know, people like you, myself, doing this already after 8 weeks. We, with the brain scans, can see effects, measure them.
All right, I've got to bang a few questions at you. One or two of them are going to be a bit tricky, and I know it's nearly, 8:35 in the PM and you haven't had a coffee, so do your very best. Maybe drink some water.
Magic water.
Get some of that into you. That might help the old cognitive function a little bit. I remember listening to you talk and you said initially you weren't a big, you didn't have a lot of faith in the idea of mindfulness. You kind of, I'm paraphrasing, but you thought it was junk, and then you experienced it and you changed your mind, no pun intended. Well, maybe literally changed your mind and metaphorically changed your mind about mindfulness. Tell us about your encounter with that and what is mindfulness?
Well, you're absolutely right. I defended my PhD, Craig, in 2000. And a journalist asked me at the time, Professor Lares, what do you think about mindfulness? And then as a scientist, you go and look at the published papers in the scientific literature, which at the time in the book, you can see the graph of from the 70s till today, how many scientific papers were published each and every year. And at the time, I wasn't convinced. But you can also see in that graph that since then, there's been an explosion in papers. And so we can no longer say, like, this is fluffy, this is esoteric, and it's, no, it's just a scientific fact. And I think that it's something we could actually use more, definitely in my profession as a medical doctor. But again, also in schools, I think it's a bit strange that we have, I think it's the same in Australia, right? You have primary school, secondary school, there's gymnastics. It's part of the curriculum with a specific teacher.
Similar, yeah.
Why not organize the same for our mental well-being? It's so important. And I think just a matter of time before this will really become part, because our brain and mind is not a computer. And computers can do calculations and you know, we have Wikipedia and Google and everything. So we should invest in things that computers cannot do. They actually can't feel. And our creativity, our emotions is something that I'm definitely, you know, trying to change that. And preparing actually in Belgium, the next book will be the meditation book for children coming up.
Perfect. And what I think a lot of people don't, and I don't obviously understand it fully as you do, but my observation and experience is that, you know, the practice of mindfulness and meditation, where we initially obviously think it's all about calming the mind and you know, getting out of your thoughts and finding that space of equanimity or whatever. But also we know that not only just are there benefits for the mind, but there are physiological kind of consequences and benefits for the nervous system, for you know, for the cardiovascular respiratory system, for you know, the endocrine system. Like literally we can change, we can influence our biology with our mind. Like you think, why do we take a pill or a tablet or some medication? Well, to change what's happening in our body to produce a better state or a better outcome. And we can change the biochemistry of our body with our mind if we kind of know what we're doing. And I know not with everything, and I know it's not easy or instant, but this, I think starting to, this is what fascinates me right now, is just understanding and developing this mind, emotion, body interaction and relationship. And I know it's a very often used mind, body, emotion term, But genuinely understanding the relationship between psychology and physiology, or mind and body, and realizing that that's real, I think the challenge is almost like learning how to drive it. It's like, yeah, we've got this amazing machine that we can't drive.
Well, I think that the interaction is there. It's real. It's very complex. So complex that for a long time, you know, we considered it too complicated to study. But yes, you can have an impact. And this whole field of neuroplasticity, you know, your brain is changing the whole time. Anyone remembering anything from this podcast actually changed thousands of billions of brain connections. And so you can train this just the way as you can train your body. If you start running, you will get strong legs. Start swimming, you will get strong shoulders. Of course, you can see that what's happening in your brain. You need fMRIs to see the effect, but you could compare it. And to me, what is meditation? It's a little bit like asking the question, what is sport? It's for me, meditation is gymnastics for the mind. It's really training your attention. In the book, I give a couple of very simple examples. Maybe we can do one, Craig.
I'm ready.
Okay. So, Viv, Craig, everyone with us, I would invite you to very short, very easy, have the breathing meditation where we'll take a couple of conscious breaths and we focus our attention to the breathing. It's an anchor. You can do it anywhere, anytime.
Can I just say perhaps not for those that are driving?
Yeah, indeed. Pull over. There's other exercises you can do when you're driving. This one, you know, you need to be stuck in traffic jam. But for everyone sitting somewhere, just sit comfortably. We'll do the exercise and focus the attention to the breathing. It may and probably will happen. You will have thoughts. You just observe that happening and bring the attention back to your breathing. So put both feet comfortably. You can have your hands on your legs, close your eyes and straighten your back comfortably. And we will inhale through the nose, exhale through the mouth. Doing great. Inhale. You can count, this can help. So one, wonderful, two. Let's exhale a little bit longer. Three more. Very good. In. Last one, Craig. That's it. Open your eyes, reconnect the here and now. Seemingly easy.
Wow.
That's what I do in my consultation between two patients. You can check it with your smartwatch. Your heart rate will go down. Blood pressure will go down. Stress hormones, cortisol, noradrenaline. So that's one very basic exercise. Focus your attention. Here is the breathing, but you can do this on an object. Some people would repeat a mantra in their head. You know, I've got a lot of feedback now from the Christian world, people praying. Actually, it's a kind of mantra meditation. So this, you can do it formally, but you can, and I think that's the final aim of meditation. It's to have this part of your daily routine. So do this at work, when you commute, when you're in the, you know, grocery store waiting to pay your stuff, anywhere, anytime. And a couple of minutes, the first breath is the most important. So don't feel obliged, you know, do this 20 minutes. Yes, yes. Meditation is no competition. So do what you can. And this is just one exercise. There's many, many, many. The only thing you need is curiosity and give it a try.
I love it. All right, I've got a few specific questions for you. Maybe just because I want to get through a bit, and we've got about 15 minutes to go. So maybe if we can one or 2 minutes on each, no pressure. I'm just going to ask you questions that require 1 hour, and I want you to condense it to a minute. No, I don't. What have you learned? What's the biggest revelation that's come for you, or realization, opening the door on near-death experiences? What have you learned?
Oh, I think I was a bit arrogant in the beginning of my career, and my wife will agree. She's a psychologist. So, you know, as a scientist, scientists have big egos, you know, professors, academics. And when we talk about death, it's really a big frontier, right? This is the irreversible event. So near-death experiences, I think, are a physiological reality. We have them all over the world. It's universal and of all times. And there are also interesting cultural differences. So like when I give lectures in Russia, a good friend of mine is a priest there, Father Sergei, and I would say, well, 90% or more of the people in our database tell me this is an extremely positive experience. They don't find the words to say how well they felt. And he said, well, that's not at all my experience. Half of them, if not more, you know, are negative. People going to hell, seeing the devil, and so on and so forth. Very interesting if this is true. My colleagues, we have PhD students, postdocs who collaborate with India. So this notion of light, we would say it's a tunnel. They would see this more as a door. And in the Muslim world, it will be a river. So all of those differences, I think, are very fascinating. And how the brain in these extreme conditions, it's the organ, Craig, that uses most of the energy for its weight of all the other organs. So when you have a cardiac arrest, this is dramatic. There's no blood flow going up there. And still, you have these very, very vivid, intense memories. So some people would even say this is proof of life after death, which I don't think we can make that claim. We have scientific proof of life after death. That's another podcast, I think. That's organ donation, right?
Yeah.
So think about it. Share your organs after your death. Then you can save up to 7 lives. But here, I think we need to remain humble. And as a scientist, I don't see it, or a medical doctor, my job. I'm not a priest to say, well, you should interpret this such or so. That's your personal experience. But I'm very, very curious, of course, to confront this with our theories of consciousness. And it makes you humble and look at it as you know, something. It's marvelous, you know, these big questions. Consciousness, yeah. It's like the origin of matter, the origin of life. We really are not there yet.
I love it. Why do we tend to, again, these are not necessarily directly in your wheelhouse, but I think you'll cope. Why do you think we humans, I'm generalizing, so if I'm not talking about you folks, ignore this question, but why do we so often find our sense of self or identity or self-worth in our things, in our stuff? Our brand, our business, our bank balance, our car, our house, all the external things we're we get our sense of who I am from all this stuff that everyone can see rather than what's happening internally.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge. And that's what I love with people like Matthieu Ricard, this Buddhist monk. I spend a day with the Dalai Lama, wonderful person. And these guys, they are their message, right? They own nothing, and they. So how do we, simple mortals, do that? You know, I drive a car. I'm polluting. I'm taking a plane. You know, I. So many things we love, beautiful objects, and it's about finding that balance, right? So we know, and I'm in a good position to. Through my job in intensive care, emergency medicine, neuro rehab, you know, we see the Schumachers, you know, Michael Schumacher, Ariel Sharon, all these the people went through terrible things, and then the suffering is the same. And then you see what really matters.
Yes.
See a lot of top people in all fields. Dying also, unfortunately. I'm also working palliative care. So you learn from that. I never ever had someone on his deathbed saying me, you know, doctor, I wish I had, you know, spent more time at work. It's really the contrary. Then you see what really matters. It's not, you know, the time at work or what you own. It's the quality of your relationships. And often, of course, unfortunately, you need to hit bottom or some crisis. And it's a very difficult question, Craig, if how we find happiness. If you look for it too hard, it's not going to happen.
I think part of it is we get taught and trained and told and programmed growing up that success is things, you know. That's part of it, is that's the kind of environment that we grow up in. But anyway, let's leave that one. Let's move on, because I've got some hard stuff for you, which you're probably going to struggle with because it's nearly 9 o'clock. Is spirituality a story? Is spirituality a byproduct of the mind, or is it something that exists separate to the mind?
Whoa.
Or
it's
yeah, that's
challenge.
What I told you. That. I'm gonna get
as a scientist, you know, I was raised Christian. And then as a scientist, of course, you challenge everything and you confront everything you think you understand with what you think you measure. And there's no place for God or any, you know, God hypothesis doesn't fit with our data. And yet you need spirituality. I think you need it just the way you need to drink and eat and love. And how do you do that? That's a challenge. And again, it's this, you know, confrontation between knowledge and experience and giving sense. And so you can watch the stars in the sky, and I've seen my 5 children being born, and I understand the biology of that, and yet it's just marvelous. And I think it is important we reconnect with this. You can call it spirituality, humanity, or whatever. And it is complementary. So that's for me also been, you know, a journey.
What is the mind?
Well, we know what the mind is when we lose it again, right? What is the mind with the spirit, consciousness? So again, as a neurologist, to know what it means.
That's what I was hoping.
People are losing their mind, are unconscious, yet we have no definition we all agree upon. And it again just illustrates our ignorance. It's very important. We are not zombies. I've never ever seen a zombie. And we have these thoughts, perceptions, emotions. All of that makes up the mind, and yes, we can and should study it, because, you know, it has clinical importance. It's very clear in my job, but it's terribly, terribly difficult. And again, let's not be arrogant. Nobody understands.
Yeah.
Understands the market.
Yeah. Yeah, I've asked a few people that. You know who we had on recently who I don't know if you've met, know, heard of, but Dr. Jeffrey Rediger from Harvard Medical School. And he, how good was he, Tiff?
Oh, he was so good.
I loved him. I loved him. So he, it's all right. I love you too, mate. So I don't want you to feel neglected. I love you equally, right? So he's not comfortable. He's not very comfortable with that, Tiff.
I'm doing my meditation right now, Craig. Oh, it's okay. It's okay.
Tell you what, we might need to open the door on that. We might need to get him back. Maybe the counselor needs some counseling. Hey, but he talks about spontaneous healing. And that's such an interesting thing. And obviously it's not spontaneous, but he spoke about how people kept presenting him with all of these cases, and he ignored it and ignored it. And then finally he went to Brazil to look at all of these alleged cases of miraculous recoveries. And yeah, he's been doing that for nearly 20 years. And he also, medical doctor, also have a master's in divinity, psychiatrist, and also I think, I'm not sure if he has a PhD in something, but yeah, fascinating. Have you ever, that whole kind of, and we don't have time, I know, but the placebo, nocebo, that kind of healing stuff, the mind healing stuff, have you ever opened that door?
We studied the placebo effect, published how people just by thinking they receive something, you know, really get better, and we struggle with that. We find it annoying nearly in the scientific community. It's so wonderful. We should just use it more. And that's why meditation, hypnosis. We have more than 10,000 patients in my university hospital who had surgery, myself included, while being awake, you know, in this dissociated state of absorption. So all of these are illustrations of the power of the mind. And I think sometimes we see it like black or white, right? There's classical medicine, there's alternative medicine. To me, it doesn't make sense. You know, it's my challenge is to bring those together and have the benefits of both. I'm very, very happy there's, you know, the technology, the knowledge, and big pharma, and these, you know, save us. Again, with COVID, very, very happy that people identify the virus. But it doesn't, mean we should not, you know, go for all the rest. And there is this power of the mind that I believe we are not using to its full potential, hence the book.
Well, you're amazing. We really appreciate you having a chat with us. The book is called The No-Nonsense Meditation Book, A Scientist's Guide to the Power of Meditation. Also, as Stephen mentioned, if you've had a near-death experience and want to give him some input or feedback or a snapshot of your story, we'll put up how you can do that. We'll put that information in the show notes. How can people support you and follow you, Stephen? Are you on social media? Do you have a website?
Yeah, you need to be. So everything out there, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, you know, at Dr. Stephen Larez. Connects, and very happy to listen to you and your wonderful experiences in this search for the human mind and consciousness.
Perfect. Well, thank you for taking the time. Stay on the call if you would. We'll say goodbye to everybody and goodbye to you off air in a moment. Tiff, thank you. Good get.
Thank you, Harps. I enjoyed that. Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah, so much to think about.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Doc. Love you guts.
Take care.
Thanks, everyone. Love you guts.